How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can, too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, Bob Corker's tweets, Jeff Flake's speech, congressional Republicans seem to be revolting against their president. But is that really what's happening? And the leader of China consolidates his power. It's Thursday, October 26th.
All right, Glenn is here.
Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Glenn.
Hello.
Oh, yeah. Well, you don't get a last name because you're such a household item at this point. You're like Tide.
Charo. Remember Charo?
No. What's the other thing you're like?
Kleenex?
The Kleenex. Kleenex. Very nice.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. Glenn, why was Tuesday such an important day for Republicans in Washington?
Well, Michael, on its surface, it was a day of historic insurrection by the Republican rank and file against a Republican president.
I don't know why he lowers himself to such a low, low standard and debases our country in the way that he does, but he does.
It started off with this incredibly vicious fight between Bob Corker, who is the powerful head of the Foreign Relations Committee, and the president, just exchanging these mutually assured destruction kind of tweets and comments about each other.
Do you think he's a role model to children in the United States?
No.
You don't?
No, absolutely not.
Well, President Trump attacked Corker, of course, in a series of tweets this morning. Trump said Corker, quote, couldn't get elected dog catcher in Tennessee. He said Corker dropped out of the race in Tennessee when he refused to endorse him and now is only a negative on anything Trump. He called him a lightweight and the incompetent head of the Foreign Relations Committee. Trump tweeted.
Then the president decides to come up to the weekly Republican lunch on Capitol Hill to soothe things over. And then really the most extraordinary thing of all.
We must never regard as normal the regular and casual undermining of our democratic norms and ideals. We must never meekly accept the daily sundering of our country.
In the afternoon, Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake, a really dyed-in-the-wool conservative, comes out on the Senate floor and in a way that no one has really done before in the Senate, calls Trump out specifically for degrading discourse and says,
I've decided that I would be better able to represent the people of Arizona and to better serve my country and my conscience by freeing myself of the political consideration that consumed far too much bandwidth and would cause me to compromise far too many principles.
A really, really extraordinary day.
And you said on its surface. Why'd you put it that way?
Because Donald Trump owns the Republican base. The truth of the matter is Republican voters are much more with Donald Trump than they are with Jeff Flake. And the reason why Jeff Flake was giving this speech is because he probably can't win re-election.
And what about Bob Corker?
Well, Bob Corker has also decided not to run. His electoral prospects were a little bit better. But here's what's really interesting. You have two guys who essentially are getting off the island deciding to torch the president. Right. We have not seen that coming from people who are still in the institution, who are still doing business with the president. Mm-hmm. They are afraid that Donald Trump owns the real estate that they have built their political careers on. So this is all about fear. And the truth of the matter is, the first time I have ever experienced real apprehension in Mitch McConnell's camp was when Trump went after him. McConnell is an unflappable political player. He's not somebody who lives from day to day worrying about his existence. That tells you a lot about the strength of Donald Trump, despite the fact that his national approval ratings are in the high 30s and low 40s.
Right. I mean, because arguably Jeff Flake was accusing, among others, Mitch McConnell of being complicit.
Yeah, he was accusing the entire Republican, quote unquote, establishment of going along with this guy. And, you know, they are in a huge bind, both a political bind back at home and a sense of existential crisis. Why do they exist? What does the Republican Party exist to do? They haven't passed anything. It seems like it's coming down to two things: judicial appointments, which Mitch McConnell is obsessed with, and this tax reform.
So let's talk about how tax reform fits into all of this that we're talking about.
Tax reform is the deus ex machina right now. It is the one thing that can bring the party together and save it from this perception that Donald Trump and the Republican-controlled House and Senate have done nothing. I ran into Lindsey Graham in the hallway today. Somebody asked him, how important is tax reform to the Republican Party? And Graham said, we don't do tax reform. There is no Republican Party. And then someone said, how important is tax reform to Donald Trump? Lindsey Graham said, tellingly, if we don't get tax reform, there is no Donald Trump Republican Party.
Hmm.
I think it is a sine qua non. If they come away empty-handed, they're in real, real trouble.
I feel like my Latin teacher would really admire your use of those two Latin phrases, deus ex machina and sine qua non. I wrote them down. I was really impressed. So is tax reform the thing that's motivating congressional Republicans and Trump to work together and maybe for some of these Republicans to stay quiet?
It's the only thing that they have right now. And what's fascinating about this is the package that is going presumably to bring the Republican Party together and heal all of these divisions that we've been talking about is, as far as I can tell, polling very poorly with the American public. Trump, to his credit, seems to understand this and is emphasizing the low-end cuts for people. But it's a very dangerous game. If the perception is that this is done to favor the rich, it could be a very, very bad outcome for the Republicans.
Because if the tax plan appears to favor the rich, that's completely at odds with this Trump base that you've just been describing that remains quite powerful.
Yeah, the one that Steve Bannon calls his hobbits. They are not interested in seeing Wall Street or real estate interests in New York and the big cities getting tax breaks.
So who at this point needs who more in this equation? Does Trump need congressional Republicans or do they need him?
They're sort of in this symbiotic wrestling match. You know, it's either an embrace or a headlock. Can't figure out what it is. They both need each other fairly equally. For Trump to get any sort of a deliverable, a win, as he puts it, he needs them to come together on tax reform. And for Republicans in the Senate and in the House, they need Trump to be sufficiently quiet to allow themselves to get reelected. So it's a classic formula for a deal getting done. The question is, will all these personal conflicts get in the way?
Glenn, thank you very much.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
We'll be right back.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for the New York Times covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating to these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
This week, thousands of communist delegates from around the country met in Beijing, where China's president, Xi Jinping, took the stage in the Great Hall of the People to address the political elite.
As he steps up to the podium, the president of China gives his work report.
My colleague Chris Buckley is a reporter in China.
And this particular work report lasted for over 3 hours. So it was quite a marathon to sit through, and probably even more of a marathon for Xi Jinping to deliver. Without any pee breaks, I should mention.
Without any bathroom breaks?
No bathroom breaks at all. So if nothing else, it's a feat of stamina. But what it also was is a very symbolically important moment in Xi Jinping's rule.
前景十分光明,挑战也十分严峻.
Because on Tuesday, the ideas that Xi Jinping put forward were officially written into the Communist Party's constitution, effectively turning them into political theory, something that has happened only 3 times in China's history, one time being with Chairman Mao.
没有,没有,没有,没有,通过.
The difference this time is that Xi Jinping is a contradictory figure in China, simultaneously embracing the country's growth as a global power and doubling down on the country's restrictive communist ideology. Chris, tell me about the man himself. Who was Xi before his political rise in the Communist Party?
Xi Jinping was born in Beijing in a compound for Communist Party officials. As Xi Jinping puts it, he has red genes.
Right.
But then something happened, which I think was really important in understanding the kind of leader he became. So in 1962, his father was purged by Mao, the leader of the Chinese Revolution.
Which is to say, was removed from the party.
He wasn't immediately removed from the party. He was placed under investigation and detention, and he disappeared from his family. So they didn't know where he was. And Mao suspected Xi Jinping's father of being involved in plotting against him, against Mao. So suddenly the family found itself under suspicion. And so I think that's part of Xi Jinping's background as well, this sense that we have to protect ourselves. And protect ourselves, we have to protect what power we have. And so the idea of letting go of power, of liberalizing, I think is kind of foreign to him.
And with that in mind, what else is Xi Jinping trying to accomplish domestically that reflects that?
Well, what Xi Jinping has done over the past 5 years is to reestablish control over Chinese society, over civil society, and over the Communist Party as well. So all of these venues in which people might be able to express themselves or perhaps organize are coming under greater party control. The simple act of getting on the internet and getting on foreign news sites is much more difficult than it is in usual times when it's hard enough. You just never know why certain things are taken down or why certain things give offense. So we did have some reports earlier about Winnie the Pooh being censored. And part of it was when Xi Jinping met President Obama.
We first met during my visit to China in 2009, and I had the opportunity to welcome him to the Oval Office last year.
The two of them went for a stroll on the lawn. You might remember the scene with the two leaders, unbuttoned shirts, looking very relaxed, strolling on, I guess it was on the golf greens. Obama is quite a lanky man. Xi Jinping is a rather more dumpy man. So almost as soon as that photo came out, there were pictures blossoming on the Chinese internet comparing them to Tigger and Winnie the Pooh.
There's word that China is censoring the Winnie the Pooh on social media. It's aimed at comic comparisons of the pudgy bear with President Xi Jinping.
So I suspect, and it's only a suspicion, is that the more recent disappearances of Winnie the Pooh have something to do with that image.
I mean, you told us that Xi Jinping witnessed his own father essentially have his career destroyed by the Communist Party and feared how quickly power can crumble. Is what you're describing a Communist Party leader who has absorbed these lessons and is applying them to the flow of information and to censorship and making sure that there are no surprises and there's no possibility of him losing control?
Yes, I think for Xi Jinping, maintaining control and maintaining Communist Party control is really his life's work in order to propel it into the 21st century as a great power. I think his upbringing is part of it, but there's other more recent things that come into play as well. You have to go back to the 1980s in China, a period of intense intellectual ferment and aspirations for change. There was a great deal of interest in Western ideas and books and novels, television shows. All of that was coming into China. And what Xi Jinping saw in the 1980s and that ferment in China eventually led to the demands for democracy and clean government that inspired students to occupy Tiananmen Square. It was a time of ferment in the Soviet bloc as well. And what he saw outside of China, reading the newspapers, looking at the television, is the Soviet Union embark on this process of liberalization that eventually failed.
Repeating once again our top story, Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has been removed from power, and there are tanks now in the streets of Moscow.
And led to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Great Soviet Communist Party, as Xi Jinping calls it. So I think apart from Xi Jinping's background, it's these historic episodes that he's seen happening as well that have reinforced this sense of danger, this sense that the Communist Party really has to keep itself in power and in control of China's security in order to secure its long-term survival.
Chris, it seems a bit contradictory that a nation can tighten political controls the way Xi has tightened them while expanding its economic and its military reach around the world. It seems counter to traditional models of how a country becomes a superpower.
And I think part of the problem there is it's very difficult for people to understand that Xi Jinping sees himself as I call him a conservative reformer. So in other words, he's very committed to preserving certain parts of China. But he's also a reformer. He sees somebody who believes that in order to preserve these underlying values and in order to preserve the one-party state, China also has to grow and has to expand its international influence. One area where they've been able to establish their credentials as a more benign leader is in climate change.
Two dramatically different photo ops just hours apart. Chinese President Xi Jinping planting trees in Beijing, talking about protecting nature. President Trump signing an executive order in Washington, dismantling President Obama's climate change policies.
Its economic influence in the world is growing. If you spend any time in Beijing talking to business people and officials, there's one word you'll hear associated with Xi Jinping, which is obor, one belt, one road. So what the Chinese government has been doing under Xi Jinping is more or less going around to countries saying, join our program, join One Belt, One Road, and we'll help build all of these roads and bridges and ports, and we'll knit you into our nexus of trade. That shows how Xi Jinping operates. He wants to put Chinese power into practice, and that's one way in which he's been doing it.
And Chris, how do the people inside China square all this progress internationally with this communist ideology that is still so restrictive, in many ways increasingly restrictive? Do they welcome this kind of contradictory new era?
I think it's almost universally true that a lot of us walk around with contradictory ideas and values in our heads. And I think that's especially true of Chinese people simply because they've lived through so much dramatic change and they live in such a contradictory system. So one that exposes them to the world of McDonald's and international capitalism. But one that also insists that they remain good communists, committed to the idea of a one-party state, and committed to the idea that the West is some sort of enemy.
Right.
So for Chinese people, you just simply have to live through these contradictions. And sometimes you live through those contradictions more or less by simply accepting them. And I think in particular what Xi Jinping is now offering people is a kind of a bargain of sorts. If you accept the rule of the Chinese Communist Party, if you accept the one-party state, what it will offer you is China's increasing prominence in the world, an increasingly prosperous economy, and security for yourself. But the price of that is that you have to accept political conformity and silence.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.